Item number four, Open Public Meetings Act, Public Disclosure and Public Records Training. I'm ready to be trained.
Good afternoon, Commissioners.
Again, I'm Bill Freymeyer with the AG's office, and with me is Michael Young. And I just wanted to say that one of the requirements of the Open Public Meetings Act, this was an amendment from a couple of years ago, was that every 4 years, boards that are subject to the Open Public Meetings Act need to have training on the Open Public Meetings Act. Most new appointees coming through the governor's office get that training at the time of their thing, but we figured this was a time that we could make sure all the rest of you got your four-year thing. And so without further ado, Michael Young, he's our lead on public records actions and also does Open Public Meetings Act issues for the State Parks Commission, is going to help by doing it.
Right. Thanks, Bill. So again, I'm Michael Young with the Attorney General's Office. It's a pleasure to be here before you, Commissioners. As Bill mentioned, I am essentially the bill equivalent for the Parks and Recreation Commission, and this is a slightly modified version of a training I did for them. So if I slip up and refer to you all as the Parks Commission, I apologize in advance. So as Bill noted, our purpose here is to, in part, to meet the requirements of the Open Government Trainings Act, which, as Bill mentioned, mandates Open Public Meetings Act training for boards and commissions. But we also, of course, also want to give you knowledge of your obligations under both the Public Records Act and the Open Public Meetings Act. And the ultimate goal, of course, is to promote compliance with both of those laws. So we'll start with some OPMA and Public Records Act basics. These are both state statutes. The OPMA is in Chapter 4230 RCW. The Public Records Act is in 4256 RCW. They are both what are called sunshine laws. They're intended to make sure the public has the opportunity to oversee the conduct of public business. Both apply to this commission and to you as commissioners individually, and the PRA also applies to agency staff. Both of them are to be construed liberally in favor of transparency and public access, and that's something we'll talk about. That notion comes up in just about every court case that interprets either the Public Records Act or the OPMA. Both of them impose some pretty serious penalties for non-compliance, so want to make sure we avoid that. But there are some key distinctions between the two acts, and so we'll point those out as we go through this training today. I want to point out at this point that both of these, our discussion of both the OPMA and the Public Records Act, this is sort of the 101 level. This is a very high level discussion. We won't get into any of the details. But if you at any point have questions about either act, please feel free to interrupt me and chime in, and we'll answer them. There may be some questions that we'll want to answer offline because they're so specific. They're better suited to a more one-on-one discussion. Yes, Commissioner?
Is this slide in our materials electronically so we could go back to it, or in our briefing books?
Yes, sir.
It is? Okay.
Yeah, the presentation I'm giving you today has some very slight changes from the one that's in your book, but the overall it's the same as what's in your book. So the Open Public Meetings Act, the OPMA, the basics of this, the basic point is that public business be conducted in public. The Act includes this language that states the purpose of the Act. And the important language here is it is the intent of this chapter that the actions of boards like yours be taken openly and that deliberations be conducted openly. And there's this language, the people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments that they have created. So the basic requirements of the OPMA is that all meetings of a governing body of a public agency be open and public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of the governing body of a public agency except as otherwise provided in the OPMA. So what is a governing body of a public agency? That's a specific defined term in RCW 4230.020, subsection 1 and 2. won't get into the details of it, but the Fish and Wildlife Commission is the governing body of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which is a public agency for purposes of the OPMA. Another important definition, what is a meeting? 4230020 subsection 4 defines meeting. This is classic sort of legal definition. A meeting is a meeting at which action is taken. So a meeting requires a quorum of the body. So for this body, that means 5 members. So next, what is action? Another critical definition. 4230020 subsection 3 says that action means the transaction of the official business of a public agency by a governing body, and includes but is not limited to receiving public testimony, deliberations, discussions, considerations, reviews, evaluations, etc., and final actions. Yes, sir. That's right.
You do not have to have a final action to constitute a meeting.
Correct. That's
so,
correct.
So if you have 5 forms, deliberating, discussing, reviewing, evaluation, that is an action.
Right. Yep. And I'm glad you mentioned that, and that's a really important point. And we'll talk about, in this next slide, actually, what that means, because I think you've hit on a really important takeaway here, which is that the definition of meeting and action are both really broad, so that potentially an interaction that involves a quorum of the body can be a meeting where you might not think it is. So, for example, an informal conversation among a quorum of the body can be considered a meeting that's subject to the act. A phone conference can be a meeting. An email discussion, when you're going back and forth and you've got 5 or more of you participating in an email discussion, that has been construed by the courts to be a meeting. In theory, at least, social media interactions can be a meeting. So I don't know if any of you are Facebookers, if anyone's left on Facebook. In theory, at least, I don't think there's been a case that says this, but if you were having a chat, that might be a meeting. So be careful here.
Real quick. The following is in the Open Public Meeting Act means that if you had a forum and you were having a discussion and you did all the proper procedures to notify the public of that meeting, invite the public to that meeting, you're fine.
Correct. That's right. Good point.
You are committing. You're fine.
Let's just get your
own. Or they don't have a forum.
So the thing to be careful of is, discussions outside of a meeting, like if you're at lunch, make sure your discussion is about the Seahawks or the Mariners, not about official agency business, to avoid this potential OPMA problem. So meetings must be open to the public. So that's the general rule. In general, the body cannot place conditions on attendance, but the OPMA does provide procedures for dealing with disruptions, including ejecting disruptors or even moving the meeting to a different location if it's necessary. I've never seen that happen in my time advising the Parks Commission. I don't know if, Bill, you've ever had to deal with that.
You have on occasion. You've had some contentious fish meetings. We've often taken a break.
Wolf meeting.
And that just is enough for some people to go on. Some of the really long public testimony events, by taking a break late when people are tired, a number of them wander off, and that solved it. So,
and probably one difference between us and Parks, too, is that most of our meetings, we have armed officers.
Right. So there, as I mentioned, there are specific procedures that have to be followed to eject somebody or to move the meeting, and that's something that if it came up, Bill would jump in and help you work through. You're all familiar with executive sessions, so there's executive sessions are a limited exception to the general requirement that meetings be open to the public. So executive sessions can be held, but only on a really limited basis. Of course, executive sessions are held in private, and you know, staff and legal counsel can be present. Yes, Commissioner?
Define limited basis?
Well, that's one slide ahead. For an executive session, the presiding officer, so the chair, has to announce the executive session, explain what the purpose of the session is, and set the time when the body will come back into regular session. And of course, final action cannot be taken in an executive session. The idea is that there can't be any secret votes. So even if there's a discussion in executive session, you've got to come out of the executive session to take the final action. So this answers your question, I hope, that the limited subjects about which an executive session can be held. This isn't the list that apply. This isn't the whole list, but these are the ones that are likely to apply to this commission. So certain real estate acquisitions or sale lease pricing discussions can be held in executive session. Negotiations on certain public contracts. Complaints against public employees or officers can be discussed in executive session. Candidate qualifications in the process of hiring a public employee. Bill will be working with you on that with respect to the director here in the near term. The performance of a public employee. I assume that you have executive sessions to do the director's performance evaluation. Certain legal matters, including litigation or potential litigation when you're having those discussions with folks from the Attorney General's office. And again, there's a long list. Many of them don't apply to this commission. This is one of the areas that there can be some confusion with the Public Records Act. So there isn't necessarily a alignment between the executive session topics under the OPMA and the exemptions under the Public Records Act. In an ideal world, those would line up a little better than they do. So there's some things that are subject to the OPMA executive session topic. You can talk about it in executive session, but that doesn't mean it's exempt. The records about that are exempt from disclosure, and vice versa. And we'll talk about that a little bit more when we talk about the Public Records Act. So another really key provision of the OPMA is the meeting notice requirements. So the public is aware of what's when the meetings are occurring and what may be discussed. So notice must be given by the body. Regular meetings, those that are planned in advance, the schedule of those is published in the state register. At a regular meeting, you can conduct any business you wish. So you don't have to stick to a particular agenda. Special meetings, on the other hand, those can occur without the formal publication in the state register and not on the regular meeting schedule, but you're more limited in what you can talk about. So the notice of the special meeting has to be issued within a certain time frame, 24 hours before the meeting. And the notice has to state what's going to be discussed at the meeting, and you're limited to only discussing that topic or topics. There is a provision for an emergency meeting, which is essentially a special meeting where there isn't time to give the 24-hour notice in advance. So the OPMA provides for penalties against individual members of the body for violations. And this was recently amended, actually, to increase the penalties and to provide for even more penalties for repeat violations. So the statute provides that each member of the body who attends a meeting where action is taken in violation of the OPMA with knowledge, that's a really key element of this provision, is subject to personal liability in the form of a civil penalty in the amount of $500. And then $1,000 for any subsequent violation. So bear that in mind. And any person may bring a legal action to enforce the OPMA, and if they're successful, he or she can get attorney's fees and costs. So that is a very high-level review of the OPMA requirements. Any questions about that before we move on to the Public Records Act? Commissioner?
One question on the executive session announcing when you would come back into public session. Maybe it's at this meeting that we have an executive session at the end of the meeting. Is it necessary to announce when you come back in that kind of a situation?
How do you typically handle that, Bill?
What we normally do, Commissioner, in these type meetings is say that at the end of the announcement we give to the, or that the chair reads, is I believe there's language that at the end of the executive session, we'll go back into regular session and the meeting will adjourn. So we give a signal in the speech that at the end of the executive session, there will be no further meeting.
What is the purpose of needing to say an exact time when it's over?
I think the purpose is to allow the public to know when to come back, basically. So if you have an executive session in the middle of your day, and you clear the room out for your executive session and folks want to go get a cup of coffee or a sandwich, the idea is that they'll know when the regular meeting will resume and they should be back if they want to observe it.
Which isn't appropriate. I mean, there's no such purpose at the end of a meeting.
But. Right. Okay, so we'll move on to the Public Records Act. And at this point, I want to introduce two staff who are really involved in the Public Records and Public Records Act, Ann Macias, who's the Public Records Officer, and Carissa Borden, who is the Records Officer. And those are two different positions, although they have very similar titles. So Ann is the person who handles public records requests, and most of what we're going to be talking about at sort of the beginning of this presentation is about public records requests. Carissa is responsible for records management and records retention, and we'll talk about that in the second half of this presentation. So they're here, so you can see who they are, and if you have questions for them, you can talk to them later, and if there are questions that I can't answer, they can pipe up now. So, okay, so similar to the OPMA, the purpose of the Public Records Act is so that public business can be subject to public scrutiny and examination. The Public Records Act, when it was passed originally as an initiative, included this language that talks about the purpose of the act, and it says the people insist on remaining informed so that they may maintain control over the instruments that they have created, similar to the OPMA language. This purpose language finds its way into almost every public records decision from any court. So it's obviously very important. The basic requirement of the Public Records Act is that public agencies must make any public record available for public inspection and copying upon request unless a specific exemption applies. So what is a public agency? It's a defined term in the Act, and there's some subtleties to that, but the takeaway for you all is that the Department of Fish and Wildlife is obviously a public agency for purposes of the Public Records Act. What is a public record? This is a really important definition in the Public Record Act. And so the Act provides in its definition section that a public record includes any writing containing information relating to the conduct of government or prepared, owned, used, or retained by any state or local agency, regardless of physical form or characteristics. And then writing has this very long definition. The basic takeaway is for the definition of public record and writing is that basically any physical medium containing information that relates to the conduct of government or the performance of government functions, that it's, whether it's hard copy, whether it's electronic, if it's prepared, owned, or used by the agency, then it's a public record. And public records can include records that actually aren't in the possession of the agency. So you may have a record may have been used by the agency and then transmitted to somebody else or some other agency, but it remains a public public record for purposes of the Act. So a member of the public may request to inspect or receive a copy of any identifiable public record. Requests for public records are generally made to the public records officer, and WDFW has a rule actually that a rule in WAC that says that requests have to be made to the public records officer. Under the statute, the request need not take any particular form, although agencies can by rule require can impose some limited requirements. WDFW has a form that it encourages requesters to use for purposes of making public records requests. A request may seek identifiable public records, and importantly, a request for information, but not that doesn't actually ask for records, doesn't fall under the Public Records Act. And finally, a request can't be denied simply because it's overly broad. So the agency gets some very, very broad requests, and there's you just have to work through them step by step and answer them. So in responding to a public records request, an agency is required to promptly get back to the requester. The statute says that within 5 business days, the agency has to acknowledge the receipt and either provide the requested records or provide a reasonable estimate for when the agency will provide those records. The agency can also seek clarification from the requester if the request is unclear. Or the agency can deny the request because the request seeks records that are exempt from disclosure, or if the agency simply just doesn't have the records that are being requested. So once a public records request is received by the agency, then the agency starts its process of searching for, first preserving, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later, and searching for, gathering, and producing the requested records. The Act requires agencies to conduct a reasonable search for records, an adequate search. An adequate search is one that is reasonably calculated to locate all responsive records. So to achieve that, the agency has to look in all the places where it reasonably expects to find responsive records. And sometimes that means going outside the agency to other entities or to folks like you. So you all may be asked to search for records in response to a particular public records request. The search could include looking for records on personal computers, mobile phones, cloud storage devices, anything used by any device or storage location used by agency staff or by commissioners. And critically, the search that the agency does has to be documented in detail. So it's really important that folks searching for records document where they've searched, how they've searched, that sort of thing. So as I mentioned, that potentially responsive records have to be preserved pending the completion of the response to the public records request. So even if a record could otherwise be deleted or destroyed under the retention schedule, if you've got a pending request, it has to be retained. So responsive records that are located through the search are gathered up and they are produced to the requester. Records can be provided in installments as they become available to the requester. And those installments can be, you know, that's going to occur over the course of months or even years for a really broad request. So the agency does have the opportunity to charge the requester for copies and for certain other costs associated with producing the records. an agency doesn't get to charge for searching for records, but it does get to charge for copying and other production-related costs. You may remember that I think they got the rule to amend the cost came before them last year. So the general rule, as I mentioned, is that upon request, a record has to be produced. But the exception to that is if a specific exemption applies. The Public Records Act itself creates a number of exceptions, and other statutes, both federal and state, may also provide exemptions to disclosure. There are maybe fewer exemptions than you might think. For example, people often think there's a general privacy exemption, but there actually isn't. Privacy is an element in some exemptions, but you have to have a particular exemption that includes privacy as an element for the privacy for privacy to be a consideration. Exemptions are construed narrowly in favor of production, and only the exempt portions of a record are redacted, and the rest of the record is produced. And the agency is required to identify the exemption and provide an explanation for what's being for why the record is being exempted or redacted under that exemption. So some common exemptions: the attorney-client privilege, draft documents that reflect staff opinions until the document is finalized, agency personnel files, except where they reflect findings of misconduct, trade secrets. This is sometimes when a vendor has provided a request for proposal, they'll have trade secrets, and those trade secrets may be exempt. Real estate appraisals are exempt from disclosure until the transaction is complete. And again, remember that the PRA exemptions differ from the OPMA executive session topics. There is a specific exemptions that apply to the Department of Fish and Wildlife. That's at 4256.430. So things like certain license information for folks that have fishing, hunting and fishing licenses, certain harvest information from commercial harvesters, and that's been recently amended to include tribal harvester data, and so that's a specific exemption for this agency. So the Public Records Act provides for potentially severe penalties for violations of the Act. So whether it's failure to timely respond, failure to adequately search for records, or improperly withholding records, those violations can lead to penalties. The requester, if they're not satisfied with the agency's response, can go to court and file a lawsuit. Penalties for violations are assessed on a per record per day basis, and the penalty amount is between $0 and $100. And what the penalty amount will be depends on some mitigating and some aggravating factors that have been developed in case law. But you can imagine that if you have a potential for $100 per record per day penalty, if you've got a file full of records that weren't produced for a year, that can add up very fast, and the potential for penalty is really really severe. Requesters also get attorney's fees and costs, and those can really add to the payout that an agency might have to pay. So we're going to talk now about public records retention. So, but before I move on to that, any Public Records Act questions?
I understand that somebody will write and say, we want all records relating to hatchery production for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And is that request fulfilled when we send the requester that? And my question is, so you kind of know they're waiting for some big juicy thing, and it comes 2 days after we've mailed them what they want. Are we still obliged to provide... Does it go into the future?
Right, that's a good question. So when a public records request comes in, the agency is obligated to provide records that are in existence and that it possesses or that are public records as of the date of that request. And there's no continuing obligation to provide new records that come in or created beyond the date of the request.
Thanks.
Yeah.
If, say, a request were for all of our license holders or something, and the information that is that goes into a license includes some, like, addresses, mm-hmm. I think social security yeah. numbers, so those are privacy issues. Can they be redacted?
Yes.
Okay.
Specific information that can and can't be provided with respect to license holder information. So there's some information that can be provided, the license holder's name. I think their address can be provided, mm-hmm. but other information cannot, like social security number, email.
Oh, address. So that's in our law, then, that you refer.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Makes sense.
So I'll talk now about records retention. So preservation and destruction of public records that's governed by a different statute. It's not governed by the Public Records Act. It's governed by RCW Chapter 40.14. So under that scheme, there are retention schedules that apply to particular classes of public records. And those schedules say how long a record has to be retained, and then what happens to that record once that retention period is met, whether it's destroyed or it's transferred to the state archives. So there are some records that can be pretty much immediately deleted, and others have to be retained indefinitely, transferred to the state archives, and they keep it forever. So, and we'll talk more about this in a minute, there's what we call transitory records. These are records like, hey, we were having cake in the break room, sort of the classic example. Those can be disposed of really immediately. There are these retention schedules. This is the general government retention schedule, and it's like 150 pages long, and it's got sort of just about every conceivable record. I won't make you read this. And then agencies have their own agency-specific retention schedules, which reflect sort of the specific kinds of records that an agency will have. So WDFW has its own retention schedule, and that's only about 40 pages, so not quite as bad. So bear in mind that the retention schedules say when a record can be deleted or destroyed, but that destruction is overridden by a pending public records request. So if there's a public records request that requests that document, then it can't be destroyed even if it's reached its retention schedule. Or if it's subject to what we call a litigation hold notice. So if we anticipate litigation or we've received a lawsuit and records related to that lawsuit have to be preserved, and so that preservation requirement overrides the retention schedule. So that's a really important thing to keep in mind.
So if I could just make a comment, that's why we haven't done it very often, but we have sent you a litigation hold notice, and those are important to keep and remember. And for those things, and we try to do a good job of identifying the stuff that you need to keep, but if it covers, you know, stuff, that's what you need to comply with. And then we try to give you notice as soon as we can when the litigation hold is lifted so that you can then catch up with the record retention schedule. So stuff that can be deleted, you can delete.
So a lot of our communications come from Tammy, and I recall when we had this training initially, we were informed she's the
yep.
keeper of the of our records. So if we got a litigation hold notice that involved those and we're just kind of cleaning out our inbox, would it be okay to delete something that we'd gotten from Tammy that we knew was in the record?
So I think that if the record is subject to hold, whether for litigation hold or because of a pending public records request, you shouldn't delete or destroy it.
Nothing.
And so we're going to talk about sort of good record-keeping habits and what to do with records in just a minute. But that sort of illustrates that when you do have the opportunity to clean out your inbox, and you should do that regularly so you're not in a situation where you have something subject to a hold.
If you don't need it.
If you don't need it, right. So a few bedrock principles to keep in mind about records retention. And this is a really important one to keep in mind, and that is that the records retention requirement applies to the agency. So it's the responsibility of the Department of Fish and Wildlife to maintain a copy of every public record. But it's not the case that individuals have to keep copies themselves. But bear in mind that sometimes you're the one who keeps a record on behalf of the agency. So again, a single copy has to be retained by the agency pursuant to the applicable retention schedule. But duplicates don't have to be retained. Now, bear in mind that a copy of a record that's been substantially altered, so if you have your if you have a record and you've taken substantive notes on it, that may become a new original record that's subject to retention. But provided you haven't substantively altered the record, then it's just a copy, and it's the responsibility of the agency to retain that copy. And again, really best records management practices dictate that records that don't have to be retained and that aren't needed for business purposes are deleted and destroyed. And you know, that actually really helps with transparency and helps with open government, because it makes it easier to search for and produce really substantive, important records. So you know, when you can get rid of stuff, you really ought to. It makes everybody's life easier. Oops. So I want to talk about some particular records retention categories that I think will cover a lot of what you all touch in your role as commissioner. And these are specific categories that are established either in the general government retention schedule, this 150-page document, or the WDFW retention schedule. So I've gone through here and sort of pulled out the things that I think are most likely to apply to you. So for commission meeting materials, those are covered by two different schedules. The first one is the official commission record of the meeting. And that has to be retained for 6 years and then transferred to state archives. As a general matter, Tammy is the one who is the keeper of the official record. And so look to Tammy to gather and keep those official records of your meetings and the actions that you take at your meetings. There's another category that applies to meeting materials, and that's what's called meeting materials, members' copies, and notes. So you have a notebook that Tammy's provided to you. That's your copy. You're taking notes during the meeting. You take notes before the meeting about things you want to ask. Those sorts of things can be deleted or destroyed when you don't need them anymore. So we're on to a different category here. Now we're on to communications to or from members of the public, but this doesn't apply to tribes. So there are two records categories that would apply to those sorts of things. The first one is the community and external relations category. And those have to be retained for 3 years, and then they can be destroyed. And then a second category that might apply is the stakeholder group relations, and those have to be retained for 2 years. It's sort of a funny quirk of the schedule here. If you communicate with one member about a public issue, there's a 3-year retention schedule. But if you communicate with a stakeholder group, it's a 2-year. So I'm not sure why that is, but that's the rule. Um, tr- tribal relations are governed by a WDFW-specific retention schedule, and they just have an 11-year retention, and then they get transferred to state archives. Records related to travel for commission business, they have to be retained for 6 years, and then they can be destroyed. Performance evaluations of the director, those have to be retained for 3 years, and then those can be destroyed. Performance evaluation preparation materials, so that, you know, if you're in the process of working up the performance evaluation and you're taking notes and that sort of thing, those can be destroyed when the performance evaluation is complete. For public records requests, you're asked to respond to, those have a 2-year retention schedule, and then they can be destroyed. Records related to legislation, related to the agency, those have a 2-year retention schedule, and then those get transferred to archives. Records related to legal advice on commission matters, those are retained for 6 years and then can be destroyed. And then almost every other category of record that you'll likely touch in your role falls into this provision of advice, assistance, or other information, and that's got a 2-year retention schedule, and then it's then it can be destroyed. So that's a lot of schedules that potentially apply to you, and it's probably a little bit confusing. So to make life easier for you, our advice to you is, to the extent you can, rely on the staff to retain your records for you. And so we've checked this with the program heads and with Tammy and with the director and the and everyone. I think everyone's in agreement that as a general matter, they'll be the ones to retain agency records for you on your behalf. And that makes life easier for you, and I think it makes life easier for the staff when they're searching for records. So our recommendation is to CC staff person on communications, or if they're not CC, then to transmit them to a staff person. And so the sort of default person to transmit them to is to Tammy. If you don't know who to give it to Tammy, and she'll be the one to keep that record for you. But if you're working with a particular staff person on a topic, then that person can be responsible for keeping it. So for commission stuff, again, it's going to be Tammy. For wildlife program, it's going to be Eric Gardner, the assistant director for real estate, Cynthia Wilkerson. You can sort of read down the list, but basically the default for a good idea is to CC or provide it to the program head or the assistant director if you're not working with a particular person. But if you are, you can send it to them. And once you've provided it to them and they've got it, then they're the ones who will retain it, and you don't have to.
Can I make one quick point on that? You know, most of the ones, when you're interacting with staff, you know they're going to be connected and know this and look for this, so it's not going to come as a surprise. The ones to really think about are the ones that the agency doesn't know about. If you're in connection with some user group, you know, and having a detailed discussion and only you are getting those records, those are the ones you need to think about. And if you have any questions, you know, check with Tammy, send a question in to Tammy, or send the stuff into the program. I mean, if it's a bird thing, you know, the agency will figure out, and if they're transitory, they'll, you know, they're well trained and will do the right thing. But the ones we don't know about necessarily are your commissioner hat interactions with other people.
Right.
And just to be clear on that then, so when there is a record that we know that the commission staff has in their possession, we are not obligated to retain it for, let's say, a simple one like a travel request or something, a hours request. We are not required to keep that if we're sure an agency person has that record.
That's right, with one exception, and that is if that record is subject to a public records request or a hold notice.
And as long as your version isn't changed somehow, you know, you've edited it or something, but right. Duplicates are, yeah.
So as we've talked about throughout, good records management really aids in compliance with the Public Records Act. And so records should really be created and stored and discarded with the PRA and the retention requirements in mind. So, you know, sort of a fundamental principle is don't create a record that you're going to have to manage if you don't have to. If a phone call can suffice, or if you can create one record where you otherwise would create two, it certainly helps your records management, agency's records management. Be thoughtful about how you manage your records, where you store them. Again, transmit records to appropriate staff to be retained, and then delete records, discard records when it's appropriate to do so. Bear in mind, just because a record has reached its retention schedule and it can be deleted, if you have a need for that record, if you want to keep it, if you have a business need for the record, then by all means. But just bear in mind that you'll have to manage it and potentially produce it in response to a public records request. Another caution here, storing records on your personal electronic devices, whether it's a personal computer, it's a tablet, smartphone, a cloud storage site, can create a situation where the agency may be obligated to get those records off of that device. So to minimize that possibility, the sort of gold standard best practice is to utilize, for example, an agency email system, so a wdfw.wa.gov email address, or an agency tablet or computer. And I think those can be made available to you. I would avoid storing any agency records on your personal devices. But if you do, make sure you're storing them in a discrete location, not intermingled with your personal stuff. Make sure it's a secure place and that it's searchable. And then again, I'll say it again, broken record here, delete records when you can. On this interaction of public records and personal devices, there's been some important litigation on this in the last year and a half. Some of you may have heard about a case in which the Pierce County prosecutor had text messages that were public records on his personal cell phone, and he claimed that he didn't have to produce them, and the Supreme Court ultimately held that yes, you do, just because they're on a personal device. Doesn't mean they're not public records subject to disclosure. And the court imposed a requirement that staff or persons subject to the Public Records Act will have to search those personal devices and then provide a declaration that details that search and talks about the segregation of personal and public records. And I mean, so all that's a burden, and my recommendation is make sure you don't have, to the extent possible, public records on your personal systems, personal devices. And if you do, make sure they're very discreetly located and segregated from your personal stuff.
He talked about electronic records. The same thing. I mean, I still have books and notebooks of paper and stuff like that. This applies to paper, too. So keep your WDFW papers in one place separate from your personal journals and things, so that it's easy to search if you have to search, and you can say, I keep everything together, and I search that place, and I don't keep my stuff spread with other things. So
just to sum up the basics again, they are based on the imperative for openness and transparency. Meetings under the OPMA are any interaction between a quorum at which official business is discussed, and those have got to be open to the public. and public records have to be generally must be made available for public inspection and copying. Again, don't mix up the OPMA and the PRA. An email is a public record, even if it is an exchange between the quorum of the commission. And the permissible executive session topics are distinct from the PRA exemptions. Don't get those mixed up. So final questions for me. We've got, I think I had an hour, so we have a few minutes for more discussion if you'd like.
Just look for the ones with a guilty expression on their face. Yeah.
Going all the way back to slide number 4.
Wow.
So it's another one of your basics here. I believe it's 4. Let's see. So we talk about the Sunshine Law and that intended to make sure that the public can oversee the conduct of public business. And then the bullet one down removed, both are to be construed liberally in favor of openness, transparency, and public access. And I wondered if you could characterize what interpreted liberally means or use an example.
Sure. So the classic example is if the an agency asserts an exemption to withhold or redact a public record.
I'm talking about open meetings only.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess, so an example would be if an agency is claiming that they're properly utilizing an executive session, they're properly in executive session, but it's a close call about whether they're properly in executive session or that session should be held in open session. The court will interpret it in favor of openness. And so any doubt about whether or not executive session is proper will be resolved sort of against the agency and in favor of openness in a public session.
Tie goes to the disclosure.
Right. Yep. Yep, that's a good way of looking at it. There was a case, a recent OPMA case, where the Port of Vancouver was claiming using the executive session topic that's applicable to discussions about the price for sale or lease of property, and they were contemplating a lease, and they interpreted that provision very broadly and held a lot of discussions in executive session. There was a lawsuit filed, and the Supreme Court held that should have been construed narrowly, and the things that the port discussed in executive session were not properly discussed there, and so they were in violation of the act. So that's an example where the court used that liberal construction canon and held that that port body did not properly utilize executive session. Anne or Carissa, anything to add?
Just
all
right. That we're also here as resources.
I've worked with Anne, and she's very nice to work with. Thank
okay.
you, guys.
Yes.